Access number 29536, Mr. Bert Scrivens, Reel 9. Now, anything else about your time at Kirkuk or any other stories? Just give us an idea, because it's quite an unusual experience up there.
It is. Yes, some of the time I was attached to the water duties man who had a water carrier.
And tell me about that.
Now, he had a tanker, carried about 300 gallons, I think, and it was up to him to keep the water fresh, to disinfect it, purify it, I should say, and to dish it out to the troops and cooks and so on. And occasionally it was a two-man job.
Why?
A water tanker is a very unstable thing. Although it has baffles going both ways in the tank, the water does slosh around in very rough country. And sometimes you need two men to keep it on a, especially if you come to a stop, to try and keep it on an even keel and figure out where the hell you're going to drive. You need one man to sort of be in front of the tanker to get the smoothest way. And also, of course, filling the damn thing. It depends on what you've got. But on the whole, it wasn't bad, a bit hairy at times. Worst being when one had to cross a river with steep banks. And inevitably, the second bank, the one you had to climb, was wet with the water you'd crossed. So you were slithering up a bank of mud, which was not very funny, to be mild about it. That was a thing that we encountered quite a lot. We had snow on occasion. We had everything. We had series of inoculations. And
how did you react to them? While you were actually out there, yeah?
While we were out there, yeah. And also,
what were they for?
Cholera, I think, the last lot we had. And vaccination again. Vaccination had to be three positives inside the calendar month. And for 2 months, no, 3 months, I didn't manage to get all three in. I was positive every time I was vaccinated, but for some reason or other, the third one, I could never get in the calendar month, because I was away or doing something or whatever. I don't think I ever completed the third one.
Did you have a reaction to these sort of vaccinations?
Nope, never. No, I was lucky. A lot of people did, but I didn't. Anyway, eventually, February.
Now, nothing else happened then?
Nothing in particular. Just grinding day-to-day stuff. Oh, thing worth mentioning is that wild dogs were not tolerated in camp. If you saw one, you shot it. And that was that. Rabies was the big fear.
And did the troops actually do it? 'Cause troops...
Oh, yes. Yes, no doubt about that. You got a wild dog floating around there, you saw it, you shot it. No messing. And again, we had various exercises going from here to there. Why, we didn't know, but we did. And
were they fighting exercises or movement exercises?
Just movement, as far as we were concerned, anyway. That's where I saw my first mirage. Yeah, it was. It was a steamship going nowhere from right to left, way over the distance. It was just a scrubby plane as far as I could see, but there was a steamship there. Weird. That's where I learned to relieve the driver of one of my lorries by steering it and so on. He'd put it on hand throttle and I'd steer it from the passenger seat to give him a break when one could.
Now, you were there out till February?
February.
And what happened then?
Then we packed up and went down by train to Baghdad. Baghdad, we lagered in Lancer Camp, just outside Baghdad. There we discovered that we were going to form a convoy. Loads and loads of lorries turned up, and we all of us, because of the country and the natives, etc., we had each company and battalion had its own lager, which was very like the old American settlers' circle of wagons, except we had lorries. Those on the corners, it was a square lager, those on the corners had their headlights on shining down the line all the time. We had patrols inside and outside to prevent theft, and also loose patrols which wandered around at will anywhere, so nobody knew where the hell you were. In spite of which, we still lost stuff.
Arab stealing.
Anyway, we then started moving, and it was, of course, a convoy we were forming. The convoy was the whole, at least, of a division, which I'm not sure how many men there were in the division at that time.
Which division was it? I should have
56th London Division, which had a black cat insignia on a red background. We formed a convoy. Infantry division, I don't know, 15,000, 20,000, something like that. 16 men to a 3-ton lorry. Plus, they were Indian-built Chevrolets, driven by Indian drivers, apart from our own transport, which was already full of stores, ammunition, everything. I was told I could do convoy duties, which meant that I rode a motorbike, took a section of the convoy, mainly from the lead one of the stores section to the last one, made sure that they kept their position in convoy, their distances. We hadn't lost any, nobody had broken down and so on, which meant I was constantly riding up and down the convoy from one to the other. Didn't know where we were going. We just went. We went across the Iraqi desert.
Not on the road then?
Road, yes. Roads where they existed. Straight cross country, other than that. But there were roads across the desert, most of them. Through Palestine, Transjordan, and so on.
What was it like, this? Because it's quite a journey, isn't it? Even now, I'm a bit...
Well, let's jump ahead and tell you that the total journey took a little over a month, and it was 3,200 miles long. And to give it some sort of idea, vehicles travelled at 80-yard intervals, anti-bombing. And each day, there was one flight, and there were 14 flights. And if you saw the first vehicle going past you at, say, 4 o'clock in the morning, they would still be going past you until mid-morning sort of business. In other words, you've got 14 days of convoy going past you. We were travelling 200 and odd miles in the day, 20 miles in the hour. We started about 4 o'clock in the morning. We stopped for 10 minutes every even hour, 6, 8, 10. Midday, you stopped for 20 minutes. Then you went on every even hour until somewhere between 6 and 8 at night, when you lagered up at your next resting point. And you stayed there until about 2 in the morning, when you're up, had breakfast, and away you went again by about 4. We travelled first of all right the way across, as I say, Palestine, Transjordan, Sinai, finished up in Qassassin in Egypt, just outside Cairo. Stayed there for a few days, I think maybe a week, restocking stores and so on, rations, whatever. Went off again towards Alexandria on the road, but this time I was part of a flying column which consisted of the quartermaster, 2 military police, another motorcyclist and myself, and we were going ahead checking out lagering positions.
Is that your part of the convoy, of the whole convoy?
No, just those few vehicles. I'd left the convoy by then, or from Egypt onwards, and we did this flying column to get ahead to see that the lagering point at the end of the day was ready. That was the quartermaster's job, and we were there to assist as we could. The problem was that between Cairo and Alexandria, we ran into a sandstorm.
Now, what was that like? Was that your first sandstorm?
Yeah. A sandstorm is terrifying. We kept going. Quartermaster was all right, he was in a closed lorry. We motorcyclists were not so lucky. We were in shorts and hose tops, rolled sleeves and so on. And the wind with the sand came from left to right. We got about halfway and stopped at a naffy called the Noah's Ark, as I remember, for a cup of tea and a bit of a rest. My bike, by that time, had lost all its camouflage paint on the left-hand side, except where my leg had been. My leg was pretty well flayed, I must admit. And it was fine. I'd tied a handkerchief across my face to stop sand going in. It was fine until we went to start up the bikes again, and mine wouldn't because it got sand in the carburetor. So the other motorcyclist and myself sat there in the middle of the sandstorm, taking a carburetor to pieces and trying to clean it. But every time we put a tool down, you lost it, because you couldn't find it again in the sand. It's a weird thing that happens there. I don't know what happens exactly, but you put a spanner down and you go to pick it up again and it's not there. Anyway, you eventually got mine going, and tying a handkerchief across the air intake of the carburetor, I got mine going and fine, and then his broke down. but his was rather worse than mine. We couldn't get it going again. So eventually what we did was picked up a vehicle transporter that was going along the Cairo-Alexandria Road, put it aboard, and asked them if they were going to a workshop anywhere, which they were, and he went with his bike on the transporter to the nearest workshop, which was near Alexandria. I went off, stopped at the workshop, and found that he got sand inside the cylinder and it had his piston was peppered, it would have to be replaced and so on. The two of us being on our own, we had to think what we're to do. The flying column had gone. We knew there was only one road they could be on, so we decided between us that he would stay put with the bike and I would go on and see if I could find the flying column, which I did. And then I was told off for leaving my companion at the workshop instead of trying to find him. Anyway, we carried on, and after I think it was 2 or 3 days, it was well established that the lagering points were there, and I resumed convoying. It was pretty routine, except that we proved that there was a fallacy in the popularly thought opinion of practically everybody that you can't make tea in a 10-minute stop.
And we go on, tell me how you made tea, because there's a method of making tea.
Well, that was good. If we were going to do that, you needed, first of all, a can of petrol. 4-gallon can is better. They will always were anyway. Jerry can if you could get one. When it was coming up to the even hour, I would get to the head of the convoy, or a section of the convoy rather, where the quartermaster was, and look across at him, and he would tell me when it was, say, about 10 minutes. So I would then turn round, go back down the convoy, giving 10 signal to each lorry. Not only the drivers, but the personnel in the back, which were the cooks, storemen, everything like that. That's down to my section. Then I go back to the head again. And then I'd be given the 5 or 3 or whatever time it was to the next stop, and I'd again give them a signal, by which time the people there, according to what they were going to do, got the can of petrol ready. Somebody filled a billy can, which we made out of petrol tins, with water. One of the cooks had got a tin of loose tea, a can of milk, and a load of sugar, or between them. Then I'd go ahead, and the quartermaster would say, right, it's time. We're going to stop. Well, almost there. So I'd hair back as fast as I could, saying, you know, it's okay, like that. And they'd have the hooks out of the chain, out of the tailboards, ready to jump. As soon as the convoy stopped, which of course was in 80-yard intervals, the bloke with the petrol would run off the side of the road. Hopefully there were no mines, and he would pour petrol into the sand. The bloke with the billy can would come running up and place it on top of the petrol-soaked sand. The cook would come up with his tea, which he'd throw into it by the handful, and then somebody would drop a match, and the whole thing went up. In no time, Oh, and also you'd start tapping the sides of the billy to stop the tea floating on the top. Try and get it to run down. It boiled and boiled over. You're using a bayonet or something similar. Take the billy off, pour tin milk into it, and sugar. Everybody had to take sugar when they liked it or not. In fact, everybody did take sugar. Poured it out. You're queued up with your pint mug, dipped it in, and hurried back to your lorry when it was about time for the lorry to start off. Now, if there is anything that is very hairy, it's having a pint mug full of boiling tea in the back of a lorry that is just starting off. It's even worse when you get going and you've got a rough road. I was all right. I had a motorbike, so I could sit alongside the road and drink my tea in peace. And then catch them up later on. But that was the 10 minute stop. It wasn't done every time. You do it once, twice. But
Anything
the
else? I mean, you told us a lot about it. It's cover. It's such a big thing, though, isn't it? I mean, it's a whole.
it's enormous. If you think of how many lorries there are in 14 days at 80-yard intervals.
Were you ever bombed or attacked? I presume not.
No. That's the strange thing, we never were, and we were a sitting target. We often saw a plane, but we didn't. Some of the times we were on the road, some of the times we went straight across desert. And the only signs, as far as I could see, that kept us when we were going straight across desert. It's easy for the rest of us. I mean, we were in convoy, so we were following the lorry in front. Didn't matter, you know, wherever he went, we went. That was it. But we used to see an oil drum with maybe a painted notice on it, wooden or otherwise, you know, saying wherever we were going, or which the next town was, or sometimes you've got even a divisional sign to say, you know, this is the way. And in the distance, you could just see another oil drum. That's your road. Every now and then, we come across a petrol dump, which was a whole stack of petrol tins, the English type, which were tin plate, square shaped, punctured very easily, or sometimes we had jerry cans as well. I mean, literally jerry cans, German cans, carried 4 gallons of petrol, roughly. They had proper lids and they were stout, and we always tried to swipe a couple because they were easier to carry petrol in, or anything else for that matter. And you would just drive into there. If you're a lorry, you opened up your petrol tank, you either punctured an English or opened a jerry can and filled up your tank. And when you had, you drove off again to join your convoy.
Now, were you using your own food supplies or were the food dumps as well?
At night, when we lagered, there was food there and water.
No, so they were dumps that.
They were dumped there beforehand. So the logistics of it, if you think of it, are absolutely horrifying. How the hell they did it, I don't know. But the number of people that must have been involved was tremendous. And there were always water points at the lagers. There was facilities for the cooks to set up. We all had bivouacs, two man tents, with a fly screen on the front, which we set up for ourselves. Mine was always carried on one of the lorries because I didn't put it on the bike. And the first thing, of course, the cooks would always set up, get their rations from the dump that we'd arrived at and start cooking a meal. We set up our bivouacs and so on, as and when we could, within our perimeters, set up the lorries, of course, lager fashion, as we always did. Strange thing is that I always found, especially when I was on flying column, that you'd see nothing, nobody, absolute desert, nothing at all. Pull off on the side of the road, start making tea, and within very, very few minutes, there'd be somebody standing alongside you saying, "Bakshish Effendi." Where they came from and where they went to, I don't know, but they were always there. If you stop to think about it, there was a basis of a very good fifth column, if they wanted to. But that was always the case.
It took us
February to March.
And where were you actually going to?
We finished up in the end in Tunisia, Cap Bon.
Is that in Fideville?
In Fideville, yeah. Actually in Fideville.
What happened when you actually got there? I mean, you know, it's all this.
Well, it was very rough on the infantry because they had been a month sitting in the backs of lorries, bored, soft, and we arrived during the morning, as it were, and in the afternoon they went up to the lines, to the hills, where the British troops were, ready to go into combat.
There was no sort of settling in period?
They were straight in, which I thought was very bad. It's a personal view. I thought it was very bad, that at least we should have had an overnight settling in period and get yourself ready. But no, the troops went straight in.